Hare Krishna, good evening. As I was preparing today for this, I realized that it's a lot of information, but I'll try to make it and not so much because of our time constraints, not so much interactive. If I was doing a 5-day seminar, which is either I do this in a 5-day seminar or I do it over a course of a semester at a university. So there's obviously a lot more time. But I will be back in June, so if we want to continue this, we can, if you're interested. This is a presentation on understanding, and after understanding, dealing with conflicts and difficulties. And there'll be a lot here about negotiations and skills and theory about negotiation. And I will be showing a few movie clips, so stay, at least you should stay around that long. No. Conflict happens, right? Yesterday I quoted that verse, Prayena payasa sabya kalova shminyagejana, manda sumanda matayo, manda bhagi upadrita, that it's Kali Yuga. And Kali Yuga is the age of quarrel. And Srila Prabhupada wrote, by the way, a beautiful letter. Because I can't multitask with only one computer, I won't read it. But he spoke about utopia. And he said, don't expect utopia. He said, even in the Krishna consciousness movement. Right? Because he said that utopia is a form of impersonalism. Because we're very in ISKCON, we're very strong on this point that ultimately God, Krishna, is a person. But he said thinking that there's going to be utopia in this world is impersonalism because people make mistakes. He said, and then he even gives examples from the spiritual world. He said, the gopis. He said one time Krishna was so excited to see the gopis that he tried to milk a bull. Right? And then he said the gopis sometimes when they ran to see Krishna, they weren't dressed properly. He said they looked like little children. So he was even using examples from the spiritual world, what to speak of in the material world. How wherever there's, he says, wherever there's people, there has to be some difficulties. So we can expect conflicts. And I put Watergate here. A lot of you here weren't even born when Watergate took place, but Watergate was a very significant turning point in the history of America for a lot of reasons, but. The reason I want to highlight is that before Watergate, when a president, when a president, had, was making mistakes, well, making, he was doing things in his private life, and the media found out about it, they generally just didn't report it. Everyone knew, everyone knew how many affairs John F. Kennedy was having, for example. It wasn't in the paper. It wasn't splashed around, and Roosevelt, and there was just this, there was kind of like unwritten rule that you just certain things were off limits. But when Watergate and the those plumbers were caught sneaking into the Democratic National Committee's offices, and they were caught, and as they started doing the investigation, these two investigators for the Washington Post. They started learning more and more, and it just, well, lo and behold, it went all the way back to the President of the United States who knew about this break-in. And really, from then on until today, the floodgates have opened, and people, it doesn't, for those of you who may watch Fox News or watch Jon Stewart or anything, the papers and the media is just full of just, all-out warfare. Practically speaking on one another. And it really started in the 70s with Watergate. And religious organizations are famous for having conflicts. We spoke, there's three reasons. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the five main reasons that conflicts take place. And in religious organizations, there's three additional ones. One of them I think I touched upon the other day, and that is that we put a lot of our identity into being in our you know, the spiritual organization or the religion that we belong to. And so people who have the same strong identity, when they get together, there's a conflict often. Another reason is that often in spiritual organizations, job descriptions are hazy, right? And it's a little unclear, you know. And then especially in not so much, this doesn't take place so much in ISKCON, but the people who are paid by the organization, those who are volunteers. And what is the volunteer, you know, how much is a volunteer supposed to get into things, and how much is the paid staff supposed to do? It becomes very blurry, and it causes a lot of conflicts. And the third one is that you'll often find, and we find this in ISKCON also, that some people, you know, want to be members of ISKCON because it's, you know, it's just a nice, you come to the temple, it's peaceful, shanti, shanti, the deities are beautiful, there's nice prasadam, it's a nice place to kind of get away from the world, a beautiful place to have your children involved and get a pious upbringing. And then there's other people who, you know, want to save the world, you know, save souls. And, you know, we got to get out there and fight Maya and, you know, break up people's illusions and, you know, be radical disciples, as that's the word that's used in Christianity. And there's a conflict sometimes between those two views. Okay, next. So this is conflict resolution 101. This is the basic point to understand the difference between positions and interests. And in order to highlight that, next, we're going to talk about the orange. There's two people in a household, and there's one orange left in the house, okay? And they both want it. Right, let's say two, you know, teenage members of the household. They both want the orange. It's kind of like a tug of war. I need the orange. I'm older than you. I need the orange. It's much more important that I have the orange. And there's this tug of war. Okay? And the mother and the father walk in. And generally, what will the mother and father do? Very good. Cut it in half, right? Let's split it 50-50. Okay? Go back to the one. Because their position was, I need the orange, and the other one was, I need the orange. And the parent just said, okay, you know, I don't want any fighting, cut it in half, 50-50 bus. Okay. But if the parent had asked, what are the interests? Why do they want the orange? Well, in this case, one of them wanted the juice, and the other one wanted to bake a cake and wanted the rind. Okay? Now, if she would have asked, why? What are your interests? Why? What are your needs for having this position? Then each party could have gotten 100%, right? Because one party could have gotten all the inside part where the juice is, and one party could have gotten all the peels and baked the cake. So it's a nice illustration to try to understand this very important, and you can apply it to so many things in our lives. The difference between positions and interests. So next, twice. Okay. So in any kind of situation where we feel there's some difference of opinion or some conflict brewing, we try to understand what is the person's position, or people's position, if it's between two people, what are their interests? And we try, and also in our own lives, go away from positions and towards interests, okay? So a position is what we say we want, right? It's a statement of intent or thought. And an interest is what we really want, the underlying desire. Next. All right. We're going to have a picture of an iceberg in a second. Thank you. But, you know, in an iceberg, what percentage of the iceberg is above the water? Yeah, very little, right? You know, 10, 15%, very small amount. And, you know, so much of it is underneath. So our positions are what we see. And the interests are underneath. Next. There's the iceberg. Very good. This is where the huge, most important, you could say the main body of it is, but this is what we see. Next. So positions are easy to identify, right? I want the orange, I want the orange. And they're what's stated. It's the obvious. Next. But interest, well, I put 75%. I was generous to the part above the water. The interests are more subtle, and to identify them, we have to go a little deeper. We have to probe. We have to ask some questions. We have to verify our assumptions. Not so easy. Next. So in the orange fight, next, right? So the position was, I want the orange, I want the orange. The interest was juice and cake. Okay, so let's think of another conflict besides an easy one like the oranges. Anyone want to give an example of something you've been, yes? Okay, we need to maintain the temple nicely, and we want to preach. So those are two positions. Okay. Why do we want to maintain the temple nicely? Okay, so, and why do we want to maintain the standards? See, sometimes you have to ask the why question a number of times. Okay, so you gave one of pleasing Srila Prabhupada. Another one was to attract people, right? Now, why do we want to go out and preach? Okay, so now this one fits right. I didn't plant this, by the way. I didn't tell him what to say. But you can see that if you were to ask the why question enough, in this case, there's a lot of commonality. Right? Why do we want to maintain the temple nicely so that we can preach? Why do we want to go out and preach so we can, so just by a little probing and looking at interests, right? Then something, good can come out. Now that's just the first step of the process. We'll get to the next step in a minute, but that's a great example. Next. So here's the definition. Conflict is the result of unnoticed, unmet or frustrated needs. You ever have that experience? You ever have any needs that are unmet? Yeah, like one devotee's going, yeah, definitely. And conflict resolution strategies must help parties understand each other's needs and assist them in fulfilling their needs. Okay, next. So, the next step after we understand the difference between positions and interests. Any questions on that? Position and interests? Is it clear? Yes, Vinodji. The position, the position being multiple becomes quite obvious because people will say, this is my position. But the interests are often multiple. As Prabhuji was, oh, is that too loud? No? It's okay. Yeah, it just happened so quickly. But interests often, just like in this case, to please Srila Prabhupada, for the preaching, we could also perhaps say for the pleasure of Radha Kalachanji, there could be usually there's a number of interests underlying a position. Okay? Even Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita, right? That there's five causes of action and things like that. He often says there's multiple causes behind something. Okay, so the next point is to separate. This is all, again, negotiation 101. There's a famous book by Roger Fisher and William Ury. They're both part of the Harvard negotiation, what is it called? The PON, Project on Negotiation at Harvard. And they wrote the seminal book called Getting to Yes. And so a lot of this is from that. So separating the people from the problem. So when there is a conflict, there's usually two things going on. There's this interpersonal thing, right? And then there's the issue, right? And it's important to recognize that there's both of these. And there may be even more things, other influences, but we will, though that's, that gets a little, that's a conflict resolution 202. We'll wait, stick to 101 now. So we should be hard on the problem and easy on the people. Okay? So we should be able to get to a point where we can be strongly have different opinions than the other person, yet not in any way have that affect our relationship. Right? As a good friend of mine, Gopal Bhattaprabhu, says, we in ISKCON, he said, we have to learn how to have healthy debates. And it's like the Mahabharata, right? They would fight like anything during the day, and then sometimes the Kauravas would visit the Pandavas or vice versa at night. And the next day, again. So there's debate and differences of opinion are healthy, and they're even healthy for an organization. You know, an organization that doesn't have any conflicts is just a wimpy, wet noodle going nowhere organization. Whether it's IBM or SMU or ISKCON. So it's healthy, that people care enough that they have some interest in the organization that they go to bat against the other person. But the way it's done is so crucial. It can be greatly detrimental it can be healthy. And one thing that I hope we kind of get out of tonight is that conflict is good. Conflict is healthy. Better relationships are on the far side of dealing with a conflict. We're going to talk about that a little further in a minute next. So I picked out this picture because the father and the daughter are on the same side. Right? You see how they're both working on that together. So usually when we're in conflict with somebody, can you follow me? Hi. It's like this. The table's between us. And we're having like a little tug of war over this, and we're at each other's throats, right? But one thing, either at least figuratively, if not physically, you want to do in conflict resolution is get it so that we're both on the same side, and the problem is over there. It's different than our relationship, and we're working together to solve that thing over there. It's a very different approach or mindset. So that's seeking mutual benefit. We'll get to that in a minute by some. I hope it's the next chart. Next, yes, okay. So something about negotiations. These are the basic choices that we usually have in a negotiation. Jai Radha Kala Chanji. Hare Krishna. And you can all, probably all of us can relate to one or more styles in our own life. Do some of you avoid conflict? Right? You see a conflict coming your way and you just kind of, right? And you just avoid it at any cost. Someone starts, getting, and you just walk the other way, right? It's a little bit like when Srila Prabhupada's Guru Maharaj, right? Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, right? That sometimes he was sometimes called Singha Guru, right? And he would walk down the street and people who had a different philosophical take than him, they would literally cross the street. So they didn't run into him because they were afraid he was going to defeat them. So some of us avoid. Some of us become very competitive. If you're familiar with this, it's very win-lose. I'm going to win, you're going to lose. Boss. Okay? And maybe some of us are like that, and we probably all know people who are like that. Okay? You're laughing. Do you all have the same friend or something? Some of us are lose-win. You know, just trample all over me. Doesn't matter. I can't be, I just don't want to get into it with you. You win, I lose. Right? And often what happens is people oscillate between these two. And I had an example of that in my life back in when I first started teaching children. I only did it, I was so bad at it that I only did it for a year. So I didn't learn much. But this is kind of my default setting in my nature, right? And so I really wanted the children to like me. I really wanted to be like, a cool teacher. I must have watched Welcome Back, Kotter when I was a kid or something like that. Probably most of you are too young to know that TV show. Anyway, and after a while, they would throw papers at you, paper air. You know, there was just, the classroom was totally disruptive, right? So then I said, okay, I got to get tough, right? So I started, gritting my teeth and, walking up and down the aisles of the class. Well, of course, I never touched a child or anything like that, but, and tried to be really tough. And then they kind of got, scared, and that didn't help so I just kept on going back and forth practically for the whole year, and just like an infinity circle kind of thing or something. And then sometimes we'll say, okay, there's the orange, let's cut it in half, let's compromise, right? Very reasonable compromise. Now, it's not that any of these are inherently bad. Probably all of them are good under some situation. Okay? Just like, again, for anyone who's had a teenager, my son's not here, so I can talk. What was it? Chairman Mao Zedong, he once said, an intelligent person chooses their battles carefully. Right? So, when you're dealing with someone like a teenager or somebody like that, you don't want to just pick up your shoes. It doesn't work. You got to pick the big, the bigger issues and go for those, and sometimes just avoid the little things and let them slide, right? Sometimes this is perfectly legitimate, right? If you see a child, chasing a ball in the out towards a street, you don't just say, it's all right, let him do what he needs to do. You grab him by the neck and you throw him back on the curb if you have to save his life, right? Sometimes this is so it's not that any of them are necessarily bad, but generally they're not so satisfying. Next slide. So this is what we would hope to, and this is what is created when we're sitting on the same side as each other. We're working together to solve a problem. So this is what we call, win-win, right? You see, because it's both parties get the maximum amount. And that will practically never happen if you're just arguing about positions. Okay, it's in negotiations, it's called positional bargaining, right? Somebody, you list your bicycle on Craigslist and you list it at $100, and the person, comes by, looks at it, wants the bike and says, okay, 20, you just bargain and bargain and bargain until you get to some kind of compromise. That's slightly different than what we are discussing here, because in that sense, one thing is probably the relationship doesn't matter very much, right? But in an organization, in a family, it's a relationship's a big thing, right? So if we actually get to the stage of collaborating, where I balance, we could say, courage and consideration. I have my needs and I want to meet them, my interests, and I'm interested in what your interests are and meeting them as well, as we saw in the orange example. And when that mood is created, that's how conflicts become transformed. They actually become very helpful. Okay. But it does take some work. And it takes trying to see from the other person's perspective. So I hope, I don't know, I'm sure none of you have seen the movie Notting Hill. What? Yeah, okay. So in this scene that we're going to see, we're only going to see about the 20 seconds of it. Some people are smiling. Maybe they've seen it. Julia Roberts is playing a famous actress. Duh, right? She's a famous actress, but she's also in the movie playing a famous actress. And she was hiding away from the paparazzi, the guys who were taking pictures, you know, always trying to get pictures of the stars. And so she was hiding at this unknown person's apartment, Hugh Grant. And Hugh Grant goes to get the morning newspaper, and he's in his, you know, in his shorts and T-shirt. And he opens up the door, and there's 1,000, you know, reporters outside because they heard that she's inside the apartment. And so she gets wind of this, and she's very upset. She's very upset, and he's like, you know, what's the problem? Perspectives are very different. That's the point I wanted to make. So that kind of conversation is actually healthy in a conflict, right? To understand that they're not, because generally, we quoted that yesterday, Atmavan Manyate Jagat, I'm thinking one way, and I think everyone's thinking the same way. We're also going to talk about that, I think, in the next, is the next slide, go to the next slide? Nope. Go back. Because people have, we have different perspectives. And one of the keys in overcoming a conflict situation is getting the parties, or if we're one of the parties ourselves, to stop thinking that what we see or what we think is the truth. And to start thinking that is it is a perspective. And that the other person has a different perspective. Right? If you're stubborn, because when you think you have the truth, you hold on to your position. When you're willing to look at perspectives, you can look more at interests. Does this make sense? Yeah? Well, thank you. Somebody said. So coming to a collaborative agreement means dealing with both parties' perspectives and both parties' interests and getting them away from their positions and their thoughts that I see things as they are. We're gonna see a slide in a minute, but I'll explain it now. There's something that two psychologists at Stanford, they came up with this point of, it's called naive realism. And it's very similar to what Srila Prabhupada would call when he used the Atmavan Manite Jagat. And basically what they say is most people in this world think, I'm a reasonable person. Right? And if other people are reasonable, they'll see things basically the same way that I see things because I'm reasonable. Raise your hand if you don't think you're reasonable. Okay, most people think they're reasonable. And if a person doesn't agree with me, then there's basically three alternatives. Either they really have a totally different information than I have, or they are deceitful, or they're just in total illusion, right? Because most people, you know, we see the world through our, through our perspective. And in conflict resolution, what we're trying to do is also see the world, I have your glasses, right? Through the other person's perspective, right? That's called empathy. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I think, hopefully this is coming, you know, this is all kind of adding up to seeing that we try to look at different perspectives. Next. Normally in a presentation, everyone has a piece of paper and a pen. And probably a number of you know this exercise. How many of you know this exercise where you're supposed to connect, touch all nine of these dots with just moving your pen, making four lines, and you can't lift up your pen? Okay, Nita Kishori. A few of you have a, if you can, again, it helps, of course, if you have a pen and paper. But the point is that it's not easy. And generally, when I make this presentation, if you haven't done it before, most often 95% do not get it. Okay? You can try to imagine it. You can only make four straight lines. You can't lift up your pen. And you have to touch all nine dots. Here, we have two people here trying to figure it out. You got it? No? Vinod? No? Yes? Okay, not yet. Well, we might be here all night. So go to the next slide, and we'll show you how it's done. So there's the first line. There's the second. There's the third. And there's the fourth. You see, as I say, you probably heard this, it's a cliche, that you had to think outside the box. Go ahead. This line had to go beyond that, and this line had to go beyond this for it to work. And most people are there all the time just thinking, how do I keep within those nine dots and solve this? It's impossible. Okay? So, you know, so thinking outside. Next slide. Sorry. No, thinking outside the box. And that's what negotiations are all about. I did a mediation in India somewhat recently, a few months ago, and it was a straight financial dealing, right? It seems like there wasn't a lot of room for working together and working things out. One person owed another person a relatively large sum of money. And he said he couldn't pay, and so that was the position. One person wanted the money, the other person said, "I'd love to pay you, but I can't." So that was their positions, right? Okay. Then the person who couldn't pay, we went to his interests, and after some time, after a lot of, you know, doing what mediators do that we're trained to do. It came out that he had some money in the bank, but it was all earmarked for his son's education. Okay, and he, you know, really wanted to send his son to this prestigious school. And of course, if those of us who have spent some time in India recently know that prices have skyrocketed for some of these schools, it can cost over 5 lakhs, over $12,000 a year to send your child, you know, to 10th grade in some schools. So that came out, and it just so happened. Now, this again doesn't happen in every mediation, but it just so happened that this other man who was owed the money was a lead donor and trustee of another equally prestigious school in the same city. So he said, well, if I can talk to the trustees and either work out, a longer payment plan or perhaps some discount, would that money that you save, would you be able to pay that? Would you be able to start paying me back? And he said yes. And so, by that way, we thought outside the box. Now, if that had ever gone to court, do you think a judge would have said, okay, well, you wanted to send, right? It never would have happened. Because in court, we almost exclusively deal with positions. So this is one of the advantages. And as it turned out, it worked out really well. And actually, those two gentlemen are good friends now. And the other interesting thing about this was it wasn't really the money that was the person who was owed the money. Well, that wasn't his main interest. He was quite very well to do, but it was the hurt when we really started talking about interest. The hurt that this person he thought this person was just like, oh, I'm not going to pay you, forget it, right? So when he understood that this person was so concerned about his son, he softened up, and he got a lot of his needs met. That this person just by acknowledging the debt was, he felt a lot relieved. And that happens many times in, not many times, but sometimes in our mediations when I mediate financial things, that even sometimes a token payment satisfies at least part of the person who's owed the money is their needs. That at least they acknowledge it. And I've seen that often, especially in ISKCON mediations. So the idea is, though, that without going to the interest, you can't think outside the box. You can't think creatively. But when both interests are on the table, right, when both interests are here on a piece of paper, then we work together to try to satisfy both of our interests. And then we can think of 100 different, well, not 100, we can think of a number of different possible solutions. And you can get extremely creative. There was a mediation. How did it go? Anyway, I don't remember all the details, but the punchline, sort of cutting to the chase, is that they were it wasn't a mediation. It was just an example of thinking outside the box. That this was in Alaska, and sometimes the snow was so heavy that it was falling on the telephone lines that were also used for the internet connections, and they were snapping. So they were trying to think how to, especially in these middle of nowhere places. So someone came up with this, you could say, crazy idea of putting a pot of honey on the top of the telephone lines, and the bears would try to get the honey. And they would shake it, and the snow would come down. Sounds ridiculous, right? This actually, I read this in a. But in order to put the honey pots on the top of the lines, you needed a helicopter. And so as the helicopters were dropping it down, the wind from the helicopter knocked down the snow. And so even when they had this silly idea, they thought outside the box, and they came up with a solution. Next. Okay, so here, what are some causes of conflicts? A guy named Christopher Moore, who's written a book that talks about the five causes of conflicts. One is different ways of seeing the same thing. That point that we saw with Julia Roberts, there's a different perspective. He was saying, what's the problem? There's people starving in Sudan, and you're a little upset that there's going to be a couple of newspaper articles about you. Right, and she had a totally different perspective. I've been through this for 10 years. Later on in the dialogue, she says, these things never die. They're going to bring this up for the next 10 years of my life. And so they had a different perspective. You've probably seen this, right? Oh yeah, been to seminars before. What for those of you who haven't seen this, what do you see? You see an old lady. Anyone see anything else? You see a young lady. You see a young lady and you see an old woman. How is that possible? What do you see? An old lady. And what do you see, sir? A young lady looking that way. What do you see? You see a young lady, young girl. Okay, what do you see, Vinod? You're able to see both. You only see old. So look at this. We're looking at the exact same black and white figure. And some of you are seeing old and some of you are seeing young. And some of you, okay, see both. Okay, so the young lady, this is her nose. And this is her eyelash. And this is her fancy hat. Now do you see that? People who see, you saw old. Now do you see the young lady? Yes? And the old lady, this is her nose. This is her eyes. This is her chin. You don't see the young lady? That's her petite nose. It's a side like this. Mine. And this is her eyelash. This is her cheek. This is her ear. This is her fur coat or something like that. Yes, Prabhu? This is the old lady's mouth. Yeah. Ah, I heard somebody go, ah. Okay. So, do you get the point? We're looking at the same thing, and we're seeing very differently. So what to speak of real life? Okay, you want to keep talking? You want me to do it one more time? The young lady, which one do you want to see, the young lady or the old lady? Old lady, okay. This is her mouth. This is her chin. This is her big nose. These are her eyes. This is her hair. You got it? Somebody's just said yes. Yes. But it's a great illustration of this point that we, you know, I've done this and I've literally almost had fist fights, you know, in college classes. It's an old lady. It's a young woman. I'd love to date her. I wouldn't take her. You know, it looks like my great grandmother. You know. Okay, next slide. So we see things differently. I talked about naive realism before, remember? I'm a reasonable, rational, unbiased person. I see objectively. And other rational people will share my views. If they don't, they're either exposed to very different information, lazy or irrational or ill-motivated and biased. So if most people in the world have some naive realism in them, we have some problems, isn't it? Right? Because we usually jump to these two. I said, you idiot! How can you? Right? Next. Conflict over resources. I just gave a seminar in India, so I used a picture of a house in Delhi. Let's say in ISKCON, there's the Sankirtan leader and there's the head pujari, right? And the Sankirtan leader wants to send more money to the book trust in order to get more books and distribute more books. And the pujari says, no, we need more. We need a new outfit for the deities, and I want to get nicer flowers. And so there's a conflict over the resources. I mean, and you could probably think of, in corporations, research and development thinks that they should get so much money, and sales think, no, it should go to us. And in universities, the science department says, no, we're the one to bring in the big grants. And the humanities department say, no, you know, this school was created, was, you know, its foundation was the humanities. And like this, there's always in pretty much any organization, and even in the family, right? I mean, don't husband and wife have different opinions about how money should be spent? You ever have that experience? Yes, everyone like daily. And what to speak of children, right? They want different things. And these days, these things that kids want are expensive, right? It's not like toy trucks anymore. It's like iPads, you know? Okay, so that's one source of conflict. Next, conflicts based on values, right? I mean, here, of course, I made it, you know, the big ones, right? You know, religions having different opinions, but even that one I just said about a university is different values, right? Someone may value research more and going forward and the future, and someone may say, no, you know, we have to stick to tradition, right? So that's often a conflict that we see in Oregon, you know, sticking to the tradition and being innovative, being liberal or being conservative, right? Next. In Krishna consciousness, values are formed by guru, sadhu, and shastra, but also by our life experiences and by our culture. Everyone in this room was brought up by parents. And probably everyone in this room, their parents were slightly different in how they brought us up. So our upbringing is different. And so then that upbringing very much impacts the kind of values that we've imbibed in our life. And there can be a conflict over values. These are usually the most difficult to deal with, because they go generally right to the core of our being, what we value in life. And because the assumption is that resolving the conflict means somebody has to change one of those deep values that they identify with. So tricky, right? Now, okay, let's look at what is the... Episcopal Anglican Church going through right now? Anyone know? The conflict that they've been in the newspapers the last few years? The gay priest, yes. Robinson, right? His name is? He's the bishop in New Hampshire. I did some work with the Episcopal Church because the work that we're doing in ISKCON, they hired me to help them set up for the Episcopal Church, which I thought was kind of cool. They thought ISKCON had something to offer them. So there's this big controversy over the making a bishop who is openly, admitting that, saying that he's gay. My guess is that if we looked at that situation carefully, and talk to the people. Matter of fact, I have spoken to some of the higher ups in the organization, and those are positions to a large extent. They're not, and there's interest underlying those. And so even in something where there's issues, such intense issues at stake, a person looking at it from a conflict resolution point of view might say, why are they so vehemently for or against having an ordained bishop who's gay, right? And there's things going on there. Next. Right? Conflicts over relationships. Next. I thought I had a little thing, but conflicts over relationships obviously happens all the time. And conflicts over information. I like this one. Gossip, especially what happens is, did you ever play the game telephone when you were a kid? Right? Like, you know how it would start? I'd go up to Mataji and I'd say, you know, the rain in Spain falls. No, that would be easy to remember. But, you know, so I'd make some, you know, long sentence with a few big words in it. And then she has to whisper it in Prabhuji's ear, Arjun? Yeah, Arjun and Prabhuji's ear, and go around the room. And by the time it gets over here, it's like, you know, You know, it might have begun as a biblical quote and it ended up as Shakespeare, you know, or something like that, or worse, right? So often what fuels the beginning of a conflict is somebody said, "Oh, did you know what so and so said?" Right? It's that third party kind of thing, right? That's you know, you go to the next one. Oh, the next one? No? Maybe I blew it. Okay, go back to. This is often called triangling. I don't have a flip chart here, but so let's just say this is A and this is B, right? So A, let's see, how does this work now? Okay. A says something about B. What's that? Is it far away? Okay, yeah, if we have pens also, that'd be great. Okay, so let me go back to the gossip thing. So many times people, I mean, literally I'd say I get a conflict a week in my work where it's started by this third party kind of thing, where someone said, "Well, someone, you know, I, you know, Nritikishore, you did you? Where'd you go? Did you hear? You would be amazed at what Krishnadas has said about you the other day, or you know, I was so upset because they were talking about your child in such a, you know, and it was, I just didn't think it was appropriate." Right? And basically, generally, people will take that at face value. And, you know, gossip is what one of the things that really makes the world go round. So some conflicts over information. Oh, here's the flip chart. There's something called triangling. So here's person A and person B. Okay. So A says something to B that doesn't make B very happy. This is a little different, but it's a very important concept. And see if you see this happening sometimes in your life. And usually, what B will do is instead of saying, "My dear A, you know, when you said that to me, I felt I was disturbed because I have a very different way of seeing X, Y, and Z." Usually, B doesn't do that. Usually, B goes to C and says, "Can you believe this, A? What a guy. You know, I can't believe it. I was minding my own business. He comes up to me and says all this terrible stuff." And what does C do? Goes to D, right? And if there was a kind of an exchange, A, of course, goes to E, and E goes, "Really? No kidding. I better tell F about that." Right? And so all these different, you know, triangles are created, and it can go on and on. And if you're in a community, sometimes you can split the whole community in half, where half the people have heard from A and they accept their word, and half the people have heard from B and they accept their word. And this is called, there's a word for this. It's called triangling in something called family systems theory. So what should be done is B should talk to A. And if they can't talk, then there should be a neutral person, C, that they can go to. And C will remain neutral or will say, "My dear B, you know, you're saying this about A. Why don't you talk to him about it or her?" So there can be healthy triangling if the person that you talk to is in a healthy mindset. Any questions on that? I know there's a lot of information. Yes, Prabhu. Right. And that's why we created what we call ISKCON Resolve, which is an ombuds office where the ombuds person is that neutral person who is trained in these things. And can either say, "Why don't you talk to B?" Let's go to the next slide because we'll talk about that. There's five different level. A man named Speed Lees came up with five different intensities of conflict. In the first two, B and A can just talk to each other. It hasn't got, you know, it's not that intense. There's some problem to be worked out. There's some disagreement. If it's escalated to the point where that disagreement has kind of gotten a little intense, then usually in the, if it's gotten at least to level three, usually having a neutral facilitator, a mediator of some sort who's trained in being neutral and trained in helping parties communicate, it really helps the situation. Also up to the fourth level, which is, you know, you've probably heard of fight or flight, right? That you either, you know, just fight it out, or it's kind of like that point about accommodation. And what was the other word I used? Avoidance was at the bottom. Thank you. Competitive would be the fight, and accommodation would be the flight, right? And number five, watch out, world. That's, you know, Palestine, Israel sort of stuff. I mean, you know, often the best thing when if a conflict gets to number five is try to see if there's a way that they can peacefully separate from one another, right? So there's different approaches. And as an ombudsman, as I talk to the people, I try to understand where is the conflict at this time in order to suggest the easiest way to deal with it. Ideally, of course, you try to deal with conflicts at the lowest level possible. It's always best if two people can just talk it out and work it out. Okay, any questions? Yes, Prabhu? Right. This is a problem. It happens, you know, it's, we're social by nature, and you see what, I mean, there's more to it than this. What happens, okay, I'll give you a little more insight, we could give another seminar on family systems theory and how it applies to Krishna consciousness, because it's actually quite interesting. But I'll just give one point here, is that what happens is there's some anxiety between A and B, okay? And often what the living entity wants to do is relieve themselves of that anxiety. So when B tells C about A, he feels good. And he's kind of put the monkey on C's back to a large extent. You see? So there's a you know, as my mother used to say, there's a method to their madness. You know, there's something, it may not be conscious, oh, I'm going to go complain about A to C so that I can feel better, but you do it and you feel a little relief because now you've given it to C, and C wants to dump it on somebody, so C goes to D. Okay, next. So, how can we deal with conflicts? Now, this is the full spectrum, okay? And like I said before, each one of them has, at certain times, its own advantages. We already said sometimes avoidance is the best. Negotiation means, in this sense, one-on-one, just two people talking, A talking to B. It gets a little more intense, and mediation is better with a neutral third party. Okay? So these are informal processes. In mediation, I should define that. Mediation is when two parties come together with a neutral third person, and the mediator is not a judge, only a facilitator. And the decisions are completely in the hands of the two parties, or maybe more parties, right? Okay? So there's just a facilitator. So it's an informal process in that sense, and the two parties maintain their power to decide. Once you cross this line and you go to arbitration is when the same people may be meeting, but instead of a mediator, there's an arbitrator who is basically a judge, and he or she decides, you're right, you're wrong, you're awarded this much money, you're awarded that much money, or whatever, okay? And if that may not work, then you may go to court. and get the conflict dealt in that way. Another way to deal with a conflict may be through legislation. Now, like for example, in ISKCON, we have our governing body meetings every year, and someone can propose a more systemic way to deal with the situation, right? They may think, well, I'm in this situation, but there's probably hundreds around the world who are in the same situation, so we should actually change the ISKCON law to accommodate, to deal with it, so that not everyone has to deal with this conflict again and again. So these are all formal processes. And then there's taking matters into your own hands. And there's two ways to do that, right? And a nice example of the nonviolent one, well, of course, we know Mahatma Gandhi. But in addition to that, when we have our temple in London, well, outside of London, in Bhaktivedanta Manor, and there was a house that was donated by George Harrison. It's in a very posh neighborhood. And on Janmashtami, they would get sometimes up to 60,000 people. And the neighbors didn't like, you can imagine how many cars 60,000 people is. And if you've been there, it's one of those kind of idyllic little villages in England, right? Very, beautiful and quiet, big estates. And really the last thing those people wanted was 60,000 people coming for Janmashtami, and not only Janmashtami, for Ram Nomi, and a number of festivals, and even every Sunday would be 5,000 to 10,000. So they had petitioned the government successfully to actually close down the temple and only make it a like a seminary for brahmacharis, for monks. And what the devotees did was they had a march on the parliament with, I think there was about 70,000 people there. And, they all had their signs and everything. And they did a protest, but it was certainly nonviolent and ultimately was successful. And the temple today is open, still remains open to the public. But, they did enter into a negotiation, and then a win-win solution was arrived at. A wealthy man named Mr. Hinduja purchased a big, about 200 acres, I believe, a huge plot of land that had a different, that the access road, that could create an access road from the highway and bypass the village completely. So it was kind of a win-win situation. Because what were the interests? The village people, it's not that they didn't like Hare Krishnas. They wanted a peaceful village. And what did the devotees want? They wanted to be able to have as many people as possible visit the temple. So when they started meeting about their interests, they worked something out. Violence. Well, I've seen violence. One time I remember we were on a Hari Nam, chanting in the streets, and some rough people were trying to, were grabbing and treating in a very disrespectful way some of the ladies, in the devotee ladies. And so some of the men, taught him a lesson. And that was appropriate in that situation. So which one's right? It depends on the situation. But these are helpful because the power to decide remains with the people. And the solution is decided on the lower end of the spectrum, just between the people involved. And also, if you're running, like if you're thinking about it kind of long term in terms of a having a healthy organization, when people start solving their own problems, they become more adept at it, and the next time another problem comes up, they tend to solve problems amongst themselves, and then the organization can focus more on whatever its mission is, right? Because a lot of these kind of conflicts are often distractions from the actual purpose of that group or organization, whatever it may be. Again, whether it's IBM or ISKCON. So we try as much as possible to keep things on this side. Any questions? Yes? Absolutely. No, oh no, sorry. Only because of the, as we go down, decreasing power of disputants to manage their own conflicts. But sometimes, I mean, haven't you ever had the exam, we sleep on it, and the next day, just kind of like, well, whatever happened to that conflict, right? So avoidance can work sometimes. Next. So here are a few do's and don'ts. So this is another very important point, that there's a difference between our intention and the impact it has on somebody else. Got that? Generally, especially as devotees, we think we have good intentions. And we probably, for 99.9% of the time, we do. Right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that the person we're dealing with knows that. Their experience may get them to doubt that we have good intentions. Matter of fact, there's a little thing. One second. Oh, Krishna. Where is it? Oh, boy, do I have it here? Yes. Right. Okay. So these are my actions and the actions of the other person. So I'm aware of two things. I'm aware of my intentions, correct? And I'm aware of how their action impacted me. I'm not aware of how my actions impacted the other person. And I'm not aware of how the other person's intentions were. So this is, to be conscious of this is very helpful to help us go from intention to impact. That clear? Any questions on this? Yeah. Yes. Because don't we? We generally think we're. I'm trying. I'm thinking of examples in my own life. I've had things go both ways. I've had people come up to me, like 20 years later, and they'll say, Prabhu, you said something in a class 20 years ago, and I've been thinking about that, and it was so helpful for me, and I don't remember, even what year it was, And but also I've had people say, you said something to me once, and I, still. It still burns inside me to this day. And what do I do? Right? So, usually we're just, I'll give you an example from a seminar I did years ago. I think Nrutakishori Mataji can probably relate to this a little bit. It was a seminar with Lakshmi Moni Mataji when she had she was running a school of girls. And she had this. They lived there. There, where their ashram was about 5 miles, 4 or 5 miles from the temple, something like that. Maybe a little less. Yeah, a little less than a few miles. 5, 10 minute drive. So they would often go back after Mangala Arati. They would often go back to the ashram, and then they would try to come back again for Guru Puja, which is a couple of hours later. And the story that she told in this one seminar was that there's this one student of hers who was making the rest of the students late every day, practically. And she was in front of the mirror, and adjusting her sari and making sure her hair was, et cetera, et cetera. So this was a 5 day seminar. Lakshmi Moni was in, she was revealing to this to the group that, oh, this person just gets me so upset, I could kill her, We're always late, and she's always there in front of, she's so much in the bodily concept of life, and this is Maya, and if anyone knows Lakshmi Moni Master, she can go on like that. But when I, so I so we you know I coached her a little bit. Well, why don't you sit down and talk to this young lady, and anyway, the young lady's interest, was that some nice young men who were also at the temple at Guru Puja time, and she wanted to look attractive and nice, and maybe get a chance to talk to them. So, but the point was, she was just trying to. She wasn't thinking, oh boy, I'm really going to upset Lakshmimoni. This is great. I'm just going to fry her to the max. This is wonderful. I mean, I just really want to do her in. No, she didn't have that impression at all. She had her interest was very different, but she was completely unaware of the impact she was having on Lakshmimoni. Right? So her intentions were, well, they weren't okay, they weren't, pure bhakti or something like that, but her intentions weren't evil. But Lakshmimoni, the impact on Lakshmimoni, she almost took it like evil. Right? So it's good, it's something really healthy to be aware of. Okay. Yes.
Over-explaining our reasons why, we do certain things, and then people get sort of tired of like having to listen to our explanation.
Well, that's a different impact then. Right? So we have to be careful about that. But I think the general tendency is people and organizations are not aware of how much communications actually has to take place in an organization for there to be good understanding. It takes a lot. It's so easy to be misunderstood, right? And for people to, just get the wrong impression. Anyway, there's so many thousands of examples. It's good to be aware of, or to be conscious of being conscious of the impact, but it's not. It shouldn't get to the point of paranoia, right? We're just, we tie ourselves up because we can't do anything because we're too afraid of what this person's going to think, what that person's going to think. And we all have different natures, right? I mean, like His Holiness Tummal Krishnamurti, he could walk in a room and kind of like suss out what everyone's thinking. He had this like amazing ability to do that. And other people are totally oblivious. And sometimes I'm not, of course, I don't have the kind of powers that he has, but I think I fall on the, I err on the side of being too sensitive. And sometimes I'm a little jealous of those people who can just, sally forth and not worry so much about what other people are thinking. And I sometimes, yeah, I wish I had that chutzpah, but I don't. So being at least aware of this and not letting it make us, mental. Is an art. Next. Oh, we have to, let me see, what was the other movie about? Oh, not yet. Okay. Next. I like this quote. Speak when you are angry, and you will make the best speech you will ever regret. Right? Right? And because there's this funny idea that people are convinced that when you say something in anger, that's how you really feel. Isn't it? Right? You even see in the movies or something, oh, so that's what you've really been thinking about me all these years. Right? When you're, but it's generally not. It's generally the mode of passion taking over, right? And we get carried away in the moment, and we often regret what we said. So be careful, and this really applies to emails. Okay, my number one, whenever I go into an organization or into an ISKCON community and there's a conflict, first thing I say is no emails about this conflict, none, banned, because that there's this point that, they say in communications only 7% is what you say in communications, and 35% is how you say it. Anyone know what the rest is, which is 58? Body language, yes. So how much if you go by those statistics, which I'm not sure, I'm not totally convinced they're exactly that radical, but whatever, you know, give or take 5%. It's the point is still made. How much percentage of communications do you get in an email? 7, right? And when you're in conflict, I can just picture it all the time. It's midnight, steam's coming out of the person's ears. It's just them and their keyboard, maybe, you know, some, you know, double caffeine coffee on the side, you know, whatever. And you know, that other person's not there, and they just, and then you press the send button. And then it's, you know, has a half-life of 10,000 years, right? Because it's hard once something's in cyberspace, right? So a little tip, practically worth your whole 2 hours here tonight, is if you see yourself getting a little upset, put it in the unfinished text pile or whatever your email thing is, sleep on it, read it the next day. I always do that, and I'm hundreds of times I'm very thankful that I do that. Also, another little tip about this is I always write emails with the understanding that this could go public one day. So I'm careful. I don't say crazy things or off the wall things or, you know, thing. You know, I don't type anything that I wouldn't mind being, you know, on the cover of CNN. Because, you know, you just don't know what happens with that. You know, if you want to have a real confidential talk, call, pick up the phone, use Skype. Right? Just a little hint there. Okay. Any questions on that? Oh, there was one thing. Yeah. So this is significant. And then how you say it, right? Like if you you really see this with children, right? And if you go up to a child and you say, "I love you," right? The child starts crying. You said, "I love you." That was only 7%, but how I said it, right? And if you go up to the same, you know, especially younger child, right? And you go, "I really hate your guts. You're so ugly. I wish you were probably never born," you know? Right? I mean, so how you say it is also very important. So at least in a telephone call, you get that 35%. Right? You don't get of course, now they have video conferencing, right? So you can get more. Next. So remember, I think in a few other lectures I talked about going to the balcony, right? So here's a picture of a balcony. So when there's the heat of a situation, you know, go upstairs, look down upon it, and try to look at it from a cool-headed perspective. Next. Don't assume, because assume makes an ass out of you and me, right? We make test assumptions. We often... You know, it's that same point that we were making before about intent and impact, right? We assume people's intentions so often, and often we don't assume that they have such great intentions. And, you know, we often get it wrong. In Stephen Covey's book, he talks about the time when he was on a subway in New York. It was early in the morning, and... this man comes, the train stops, a man comes on with his two sons, and he sits down, and the guy's kind of just sitting like this, and the children are, you know, running all over the place and disturbing people are reading the newspaper, and they're banging into the newspaper and really creating quite a disturbance in the car of the subway. And, you know, Stephen Covey is trying to be a little tolerant, but he's you know, getting more and more upset, saying, "Why doesn't this man control his children? I mean, this is so rude. How can somebody, you know, have do this in public like this? He's causing so much disturbance. People are just trying to read their morning newspaper." So finally, he gets up the nerve, and he says, "You know, my dear sir," you know, he tries to be really nice about it, and he says, "My dear sir, do you know that your children are creating havoc?" And the guy looks up and kind of surprised, say, oh, you know, I'm really sorry. I guess, you know, none of us are in the right frame of mind. Their mother just passed away 2 hours ago in the hospital. And, you know, and so, you know, Stephen Covey's, obviously his whole way of seeing the situation did a 180. And he looked at it, so he had made some assumptions. And by testing the assumptions, he found out that it was actually something different. So we should be careful about making assumptions. And then in the Sangha of devotees, those assumptions can lead to aparad, lead to offending devotees. So we should be careful. Next. Any questions on that? I realize I'm going through stuff quickly. Whatna. This is a very interesting. It's a fancy word, and I mean not a fancy word, but you know, the worst alternative to a negotiated agreement. In other words, if we don't sit down and work something out, what's the worst that could happen? Okay? And this is very helpful to encourage people to sit down and talk things out. So I'm going to show a little movie clip. This is from a movie, an older movie. Not old, old, but I think 1972. It's called The Goodbye Girl. Anyone seen it? Starring Richard Dreyfuss. And I forget the woman's name. And what happened is she was a single mom, but she was living with her boyfriend. They were going to move to California. He's an actor. And he ditches them. And he has the apartment in his name. And not only does he ditch them, but he rents out the flat to somebody else, Richard Dreyfuss, who shows up in the middle of the night. It's pouring rain. Has no idea that there's a woman and a child living in the apartment. And he's got the key. He's got the lease. And, you know, he's like, okay, this is my apartment. Right? And she's obviously, you know, distraught. And he's also distraught because he, you know, doesn't want to kick a woman and a child out in the street. So that's the so this is an illustration of the worst alternative to a negotiated agreement. We'll talk about it a little bit more.
They stay up on the stage where they belong, but you put them down in real life and the whole world gets screwed up. Well, I have had enough.
She's upset. The man who left her was an actor, and it showed. And Richard Dreyfuss is also an actor, so she's saying, "I don't like actors."
I'm not getting kicked out of the same one of the apartment twice. You want your money back, Greenfields? You want this apartment? You bought me 2 tickets to California. I will give you 2 minutes to think it over before I yell rage.
Jesus, you are really something, don't you? Really, I'm surprised you didn't take a job in the Philippines.
I want more thinking because I am counting.
With your wage set, just hold it. Will you just hold the hold it?
Make a deal. What kind of deal?
I don't know. I'm just going to
buy a cup of coffee. No.
Oh, don't be bashful. Just say what's on your mind.
Okay.
That's a good thing to do, by the way, is to actually clearly state the situation.
Broadway, but I have no place to sleep tonight. Number two, you don't have any money, but you've got my apartment. Also, you have a daughter to think about.
I am thinking of her right now.
Do me the courtesy of hearing me out, please. You are not the only one who can scream rape, you know? We are both in line, the two of us. And I think the only practical solution is that we share the apartment.
I accept. Well, I accept. I may be stubborn, but I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
I have a daughter who goes to school, and I have to start looking for a job. You have a key. I would have to stand guard all day long to keep you out. I accept. You win. Get your bag. You get a small bit.
I don't want to hang myself into it.
Okay. So, Josh. So they both had, oh, we can go back to the, can you do that? So they both had a whatna, right? In other words, the worst alternative to working something out. He could have been left out on the street, right? And she also could have been out on the street and trying to figure out what to do with their daughter. So they both had very strong whatnas, the worst alternative to just sitting down and talking something out. And so when he came up with, we'll share the apartment, she said, I agree, because her whatna was so strong. Right? if she had a friend who lived around the corner who had a huge palatial house and she could have moved in there, then it would have been a different situation, perhaps, okay? But I just thought that was a pretty good illustration of... So a whatna is used to encourage people to talk things out. Is that clear? Because what is, you may help a person, because often what happens, people are in a conflict and they think they're going to win. I know I work in the legal system in India, and 98% of the lawyers, they tell their clients they have a very good case. Right? Everyone's laughing, but isn't it? I mean, that's, even if they don't have a very good case, they often, tell them that they have a very good case. So they don't say, I think you should go to mediation because this looks pretty bad. Right? But I'm working on a project with the Supreme Court in India to introduce mediation. It's called court annex mediation, where the judge gets the case and he says, I'm referring this to mediation. Right? And so in some in Delhi and other places, it's become quite a thing now where there's, 15, 20, 30,000 cases a month have been referred to mediation. Now, what's my point? Whatna. And there are some whatnas for people in the Indian legal system. One of the whatnas is it's very common that your case will take 10 to 20 years to complete. Right? Yes? So that's a whatna. In other words, that is an encouragement to get them to take the mediation seriously and try to reach an agreement. Because the mediation can happen in 1 or 2 days. Or maybe a few weeks. Usually the court gives 30 days for the mediation to either come to a settlement or go back to the court system. Right? So that's a whatna. Not so much in India, but certainly in America, another big whatna is fees. Lawyers' fees, court fees, they're huge. Right? And in the big metros in India, they're also becoming gradually bigger. So that's another way to encourage people to negotiate, encourage them to have a mediation instead of, fighting it out. Okay? Understand what a whatna is? Questions? Next. So, trying to wrap things up here in the last few minutes. What can we do to help ourselves, first of all? Okay? We talked about this verse the other day. We should avoid this satam nindam. Parnam aparadam vitanute, that the greatest offense against the holy name is to offend the devotees, the satams. So avoid offending devotees. And here's a quote from Srila Prabhupada. A devotee never finds fault with others, but tries to find his own and thus rectify them as far as possible. So that's that, you point one finger at others and three go back at you kind of mood. Okay, so we should help ourselves by being very cautious in our dealings with devotees. Next. Remember Krishna in times of conflict. That we talked about last night. And then Srila Prabhupada said that this verse, 10.14.8, thank you. Yeah. No, 14, you're right. Yeah, Lord Brahma, right? Prabhupada said that this verse should be the guide for all devotees. Tatenu kampam suksha mikshamano. That whenever a devotee is in distress or has fallen into difficulty, he thinks that it's the Lord's mercy upon him. He thinks, thanks to my past misdeeds, I should suffer far, far greater than I am suffering now. Right? So the devotee sees difficulties. We talked about this all last night as the kripa of the Lord. Next. Now, also helping ourselves, we can ask ourselves, who owns the problem? I'll explain this briefly. Let's say, because often I do this in in retreat centers or something like that, where people have to are roommates who don't really know each other. So I'll say something like, "Your roommate snores all night. Who owns the problem? Is it your roommate's problem or is it your problem? What's that, Mataji? Oh, your problem. Yes, it's my problem. He's going to wake up saying, you know, Hari Bol, you know, all fresh, Mangalarti, Jai, right? And you're like, oh, geez, seminar today, right? Okay. Now, here's a tricky one, by the way, okay? You're a teacher, and one of your students is not paying attention. They're looking out the window. And they're missing the math lesson. Is it the student's problem or is it the teacher's problem? Who does it really tangibly affect? The student, yes. Even though the teacher, you know, may want to help the student, but it's the student who's going to get a lousy grade and not learn the lesson, right? That doesn't mean the teacher doesn't care, but making this distinction becomes actually very important in life, okay? Because when we own a problem, we are assertive. We want to do something about it. We want to buy earplugs, if our roommate's snoring, roll them over on the side, move to another room, or just, you know, adjust our mentality and say, well, actually, I wanted to stay up all night and chant Hare Krishna anyway, so now here's an impetus. Right? But somehow or other, we have to deal with that situation directly. Okay? But we touched upon this a little bit last night also. But when someone else owns the problem, now listen to this sentence. This is a very important sentence. We have a tendency to take on their problem as if it were our own. Okay? We have a tendency to take on other people's problems as if they were our own. That has some difficulties. One thing is the person may not want your advice or you to take on their problem. Two, we often take on other people's problems without really talking to them and understanding. It's like, you know, like it's like if you go to a doctor and he doesn't do any tests, doesn't tell you to go, nothing, right? No, and he just starts writing a prescription. Are you going to have much faith in that prescription? No, I hope not, right? So, but we tend to sometimes give advice unwarranted, unasked for, and without really understanding the person. A brief example happened in my life many years ago. I was a Sankirtan leader in Detroit many years ago, and there was this one devotee who... Anyway, after some time, he just says, you know, I don't want to live in the ashram anymore. I want to go back home. So, you know, I got out all the shlokas and all the verses and, you know, the importance of the human form of life and the importance of sadhu sangha. And, you know, I was really, you know, really giving him a mega dosage of Krishna conscious philosophy. As it turned out, he loved living in the ashram. He wanted to live in the ashram, but he had gotten a letter that his mother was blind and his father was taking care of a farm that they had in a rural part of Wisconsin. And his father had gotten in some accident and couldn't take care of the farm anymore. And he just felt this, you know, intense obligation to help out his parents in a time of need. So here I was, you know, slinging shlokas at him, you know, left and right. And they were totally inappropriate to the situation, right? So, you know, what was it? Operation successful, patient died, right? It was that kind of thing. So, when the other person owns the problem, it's more that we become a good listener. We become, you know, a friend in certain situations, a coach, and we try to understand. And often we try to help them help themselves. Right? My wife had a case where a child was looking out the window and like that, and the teacher, you know, tried everything, you know, the standard things, detention, more homework, you know, stay after class, you know, all the things that that we hear you do in school. And finally, there were so many complaints about this child that he was sent to the principal. My wife was the principal. And after, you know, talking to him, not taking on his problem, because all these teachers in one sense were taking on their, but your problem is that, you know, you're not paying attention. You need to do more homework, this and that. And it was kind of similar to my Sankirtan story, that his parents were going through a divorce. And he was just so disturbed about the whole situation that he, you know, he couldn't concentrate on his studies. So my wife spent, I think, the afternoon with him and just a lot of listening and talking to him. And he kind of, you know, galloped away, and you know, after a short amount of time, you know, kind of got into it. Although, you know, obviously it's still the situation at home wasn't great. So this tendency to take on, when the other person owns the problem, it's a different stance than when we own the problem. So we can look at so many different situations in our lives. How many of you have heard the term helicopter parents? Right. So helicopter parents, they often take on their children's problems, right? When they should be, more like, you know, giving them some space and helping them become more mature and you know, deal with life. They try to, you know, protect them from everything and do all their laundry. And you know, like I think I gave the example the other day that I read about parents who, you know, they print out a, you know, every day they send an email with their you know, college students, their college sons or daughters, you know, schedule for the day and the classes and their homework assignments. And that's just like, yeah. So questions on this? Taking on other people's problems? Who owns a problem? Okay, iMessages and new messages will take too long to cover now, so next. How we can help others, be a good listener. Right? It's, you know, people can go years sometimes not really deeply being heard. And there's skills to, yes, Prabhu?
Okay. I hear you, but is there a fine line between becoming insensitive? I mean, you know, Sudan has someone else's problem,
the poverty is someone else's problem. We were talking the other night about conditions in Vrindavan is someone else's problem. Or is it ours? Excellent question. Thank you. It helps me clarify two things if I can remember them both as I'm talking. One is that, you know, I'm from New York, right? And so when we say it's not our problem, it's not like the typical New Yorker who says, hey man, it's not my problem. No. What we're saying instead is that there's a healthy way to help the other person, and a not so healthy. So when the other person owns a problem, it's not like, okay, you know, see you later. I'm going to go you know, have some ice cream. No, but it's a different approach. It's more approach of listening. It's almost I sometimes explain it like a tennis match, right? Because sometimes, especially, you know, in a religious organization, I'm not like an elder, but I have gray hair, or at least more than, it seems to be more every day. So people sometimes ask me for advice, right? And so I could become that doctor who just starts, you know, almost like playing God, you know, okay, you know, here's your prescription, next, okay, here's what you should do, chant 64 rounds and, you know, follow, okay, next, you know, like that. Not spending the time even sometimes to listen to them to find out what prescription to write, right? But this, what they call HPHT, helping people help themselves, is a very important thing to empower others and to say, okay, so, you know, how are you going to deal with this situation with your parents divorcing? You know, and I, you know, it's like a tennis match, because I, you know, having that faith that actually it's there, the knowledge and the ability to deal with it is there, and Krishna will help them, right? And my job is to, you know, help them realize that power that they have within. So sometimes, you know, people hit it to me and say, what should I do, Prabhu? And it's my chance, hit it back. Well, what ideas have you thought of? Yes.
And the other person's response is, but I'm asking you for advice and you're not being helpful.
Okay.
So then, you give me to another argument. I'm trying to help you think for yourself. And then,
well, I'll tell you what I do in that situation. This is just me, and it's not necessarily you. But there's a saying in counseling that don't give advice until you're hired. Right? So in this situation, the person is kind of hiring you, right? But what I say in that situation was, okay, even if you do want my advice, let's talk about it more, because I might be giving you the wrong advice unless I hear more from you. And often, even in just the process of using empathic listening, reframing, which are skills that we would cover if we had more time, and which you could cover in June if you want to, they start coming up with their own solutions sometimes. But even if they don't, by just talking, what I try to do is offer them a few options. So it's still their decision, but we've come up with three different options that may have been generated by me. And then we might go over each one of them, and they ultimately choose which one they want. That's how I try to deal with it, if that's helpful at all. Yeah. And the second part of your question, again, this is from, what do I do with the pen? Oh, thank you. Stephen Covey, but I found that it applies quite nicely in Krishna consciousness, is, there's a circle of concern, right? And the circle of influence. So we were talking about, you were talking about the Sudan, or we could say global warming is a good one, right? So we're concerned about global warming. Well, some of us are, right? Maybe some people in the room think it's bunk. But anyway, that's we're not going there. But say we are concerned, we have some concern about global warming. Well, if we remain in the circle of concern, and we just say, oh, it's getting really terrible. Did you read about that iceberg that just, broke off in Antarctica? And, whatever such and such place has, there's this huge drought in China. And we sit around the dinner table talking about that, and we just get kind of more and more depressed, right? Because if you just stay in your circle, I'm concerned about it, but there's nothing I can do about it, it actually becomes frustrating. But if you start thinking, well, what can I do to influence it, right? And we could say, I don't know what, what do they call them, the carbon footprints, I can buy a hybrid car, and I can do this, and I can, donate to this cause. And you start thinking, what I can actually influence? And when people start acting more in their circle of influence, that circle actually gets bigger. And you become more influential, right? But it's kind of, I always give the example of in Vrindavan, there's Bihari Lal's right across the street from the temple. It's a place that sells lassi, so sometimes devotees kind of sit around there and have a lassi, and they say, well, ISKCON could probably do this better and probably could do that better, and I'm not going to do a darn thing about it, but sit here and drink my lassi. Right? And that I usually give that example as a circle of concern. But somebody who's even saying, well, there's this garbage near Srila Prabhupada's Samadhi, let me go and pick it up. And that's even in that small act, that's acting in one's circle. And so the circle of influence is enlivening, encouraging. Yes, we can do something about it. So does that help? Is that helpful? Yeah. Thank you. I just have a couple more. My rule is that if I go over time, I take permission. So I would say we have about another 6 or 7 minutes. Is that okay with you all? Well, let me say this. You have permission to leave now, because I said stay till 9 o'clock, so I just want to keep my word. Next. Non-anxious presence. I really like this term. How can we help other people? It's a wonderful combination of words, right? Non-anxious means, cool, collect, not, right? And presence means really there for the person, not, you know, looking at your watch or thinking about, you know, who's winning the basketball game, or, you know, being five, you know, your mind going in five different places. So this, for any person who has any kind of leadership position, whether they're a mother with a young child, or whether they're a temple president, or in your job, you're in charge of a division, or anyone who has any kind of, you know, leadership role, this is a very important concept, because it's such a nice combination to be, because if you're anxious and you're present, you create this, you know, buzz around you that's, you know, like, you know, anxious, nervous energy that usually isn't so helpful. And if you're non-anxious and non-present, it's just like, you know, kakure, oham, tige, whatever, right? But the combination is very nice. It's actually sattva guna. To be very present, and you're really, you know, working with whoever you're working with, or whatever you're doing, you're doing it with at your best of your ability, but you remain cool, calm, and collect. And it helps so much if one takes up this service of a peacemaker, a mediator. Next, is there any more next? Yes. We talked about unhealthy triangling, right? Don't take on the anxiety. Whose problem is it? Instead, be empathic, but encourage others to either talk directly or get some practical advice. Next. If anyone wants me to email you this PowerPoint, I'd be happy to do that. That's not a problem at all. This is something that I have found so helpful in a myriad of different ways. It's a way to deal with a problem. I'll just apply it to a way that we dealt with it recently. And I was in a temple, and they were trying to figure out where to put a new Tulsi house. Simple thing, right? But there was a lot of disagreement about it and what to do. So first we defined the problem. Well, maybe I'll give a different example. An example one time of the temple only had one van, and the Sangathan leader wanted to take devotees out on book distribution and put a whole bunch of books in the van. And the person in charge of the kitchen wanted to buy a bhog at the farmer's market. Do they have farmer's markets? Okay, and this is on a Saturday morning, and you own one van, two directions. So you first define the problem according to interests. Right? Not, I want the van, I need it. This is, you know, Sankirtan is so important, the deities are so important, not that kind of thing. But what were their needs? Well, my need is I need to get, you know, 20 boxes of books to such and such a place with seven devotees by 7:30 in the morning. I need to get, you know, have a roadworthy vehicle that can pack, you know, bushels and bushels of vegetables. And then you brainstorm solutions and try to come up with as many creative solutions that we'll ask. Well, I think Mr. Patel, he has a van. Maybe we can ask him if we can use it on Saturdays. Maybe we should buy another one. Maybe we should rent from U-Haul or whatever it is. You know, you can come up with, you can generate some different options. And then you evaluate. So that's very, which is the creative brain, the right brain? Left. So this is very left brain. Then you switch to number three, to the right brain. You become very evaluative. You go through that list, and, you know, in a very analytical way, you see which is the best idea. Decide on the best solutions. Then go over all the details: who, what, when, where. This is very important, because if you don't, the devil is in the details, right? If you don't go over the details, you start another conflict. I thought you were supposed to call Mr. Patel. No, you said you were going to call. I don't even know him. And then at a date later, review the decision. So I've used this process so many times and found it helpful. Next. And that's it. So that was a whirlwind overview of what we would do in a course on this is, first of all, we teach a lot about communication skills, about body language, empathic listening. We do a lot of role plays. We would give, we would go into groups of three. where you'd have two disputants. We'd give them a role, and then the one person would play the mediator. We would go through all the different stages in the mediation process. There's six different stages that you go through. And we would, you know, refer back to the theory again and again as we were going more into the realm of practical matters. So, any questions? Okay, so again, I thank you so much for spending your, you know, Tuesday evenings here. I'm sure you could be doing so many important things, and so I'm very flattered that you took the time to come and participate in this, and I hope it was worth your while. Bye. Hare Krishna.